this is February the 14th. Marcy Schwartz and Howard Braun interviewing Dr. Bertram Dinman at his home in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh, for the Dr. Dinman. We had just about come to the conclusion of the Second World War, at least your participation in it, but I do want to ask a quick question regarding the concentration camp. What was the name of it?
Ohrdruf.
O-H-R-D-R, I think, O-F.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any realization of what you were seeing there and what it was about? Did anyone look around and understand anything? Did you know who was in the camp?
Well, it was not clear to us who was in the camp. There were a lot of bodies on the ground because they had shot a lot of them before they left. There were some survivors around. I think I indicated last time. They told us, of course, there were Jews and there were gypsies and there were, I don't know where else that people were coming from. So there was a mixed bag there, and it was not a major camp. It was just part of a larger camp complex. I'm not sure whether it was Nordhausen or what, which was not too far from there. This camp was near the Fulda Gap, it's F-U-L-D-A, which was right at the differentiation between East Germany and West, or the border between East Germany and West Germany, and which was very heavily militarized because it was the traditional pathway from Central Germany to Western Germany, even up until about, of course, until the wall came down in 1990. Mm-hmm. But it was in that area. Mm-hmm. But it was not a major extermination camp. It was just a holding station on the way to the extermination camps at Nordhausen or whichever it was nearby. I never got there, of course. But obviously, we could see what was going on. These people were in a very bad state of health. They were thin, emaciated, they were pretty bad off. And some of them were still in camp in the beds there, and they weren't able to move about too much because they were that weakened.
Do you remember how long you were at the camp itself? Was it hours or a couple of days?
Well, it was a matter of hours. And they kept on moving with the advance going through that area. So we only stayed there a couple of hours. Now, I gather that Eisenhower came to this camp with some very famous pictures. As a matter of fact, I think I saw some movie footage in the Holocaust Museum in Washington of him standing by this gallows. And I have a picture of that myself, the same place. You know, it looked very familiar to me. But I took some pictures when I was there, and it was pretty unusual to take pictures, but I was doing that sort of thing. I didn't quite stay up with the rules of the Army. We were not supposed to be taking pictures, but at that time, it wouldn't make too much difference.
Have you ever submitted those pictures to any...
I have been interviewed by the Holocaust Project here in Pittsburgh, and I think that... I guess I did bring those pictures, yes. I don't remember whether I did or not, but I have those pictures, certainly.
I may want to perhaps see one.
Sure, okay. Of course. I know where they are.
Okay. What happened to you after that, after the camp experience?
Well, we moved...
Wind me down now.
Well, we moved forward. We moved forward from there to... We didn't get quite the Elbe. As you remember, the American forces stopped there, and the Russians were on the other side of the river. But we didn't get quite that far, but we moved further eastwards, and we were in a small town. I don't remember the name of it, and then we... I was then sent back to the replacement depot where they pulled me out for this engineer and mine stuff, and then went back to the replacement depot where they finally got back to my outfit, which was then stationed near Gießen and Wetzlar. That's in Hesse, and I stayed there for about 2 months, and the Europe European Theater Operations had a quota to go to college. And the universities had been set up by the army in England and in France after the war because
what month was this?
This was late July or early August,
mm-hmm.
1945.
Mm-hmm.
So the army had set up these universities with faculty from various universities around the country, and they set one up in England, at Shrivenham, which is in near Swindon, which is in Wiltshire, and they set up another university at Biarritz in France, down on the Atlantic coast near the Spanish border. Anyway, the European Theater Operations had a quota for people who wanted to go to the school, and everybody was thinking of going home, and I knew I was not going to go home for a while, I didn't have enough points, so I said, what the heck, let's volunteer for it. Sure enough, I got chosen, and they shipped me out from Germany to England, to Shrivenham, and there we start school. S-H-R-I-V-E-N-H-A-N, Shrivenham. It's in Wiltshire, near Swindon, which is not very known for much of anything. That was in the Vale of the White Horse, or where Tom Brown's School Days was written in that area. So I spent 6 months going to school there. And of course it was there I was taking a introductory physics course from a professor from MIT, who was quite good, and was there, of course, that while I was there, the atomic bomb was dropped. This just was sort of, what's this all about? Of course, the physics professor could tell us everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
At that point. But that was I'll never forget that. Japan, of course, surrendered a few days after that. So the war was over. Mm-hmm. And there I was in Shrivenham, or in England. That was pretty good because they set up special trains every weekend, go into London, spend a weekend in London. So every weekend they spent in London. And we got contacted with a Jewish family there, who was in the construction business. And they had a couple of daughters who were pretty homely, unfortunately, but who were actresses,
mm-hmm.
I guess character actresses. And they belonged to all these theater clubs, so we'd go with them often into London. And we went to this club that was run all year round, all during the Blitz. And they used to stay there all night because mm-hmm. they couldn't get out. And it was a Victorian nightclub, and they had skit numbers, and what was his name, the English-German refugee, Jewish, he became very famous in England as a comedian, not as a movie comedian, but as a theater comedian, and died, but he was there, and that was
did you remember his family's name?
Oh gosh, Rose, R-O-S-E, they were originally South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and so we stayed with them at their place.
Do you know if those became involved in the British reconstruction of their...
They certainly were.
That was after your contact.
Oh, it was after my contact, yeah. Sure. Nothing much was happening in terms mm-hmm. of reconstruction,
yeah.
But it was sort of trying to put things back on track again in terms of the war was over, now what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it happened that we were there in England at the same time that they dumped Churchill. Came as a surprise to us mm-hmm. too, obviously. But it was a very useful experience, and I was there for supposed to be 3 months and then go back to my outfit. And I said, hey, this is great stuff. How do I stay here? I don't want to go back to that stupid engineer outfit in Germany, little no place.
Mm-hmm.
So I had among other things, I had a license as a movie projector, or projectionist rather. And I volunteered to stay on the overhead detachment there, and they made the transfer. So I stayed there another 3 months through the end of 45 and took more courses. And of course, I was able to have some of these credits applied when I got back to the United States for college credits, which was a great arrangement. And we stayed there till about December, and they were going to close the school. And then one of the smart Jewish operators in the outfit said, hey, I hear there's a quota for the UK. for people for the Army University in Biarritz in France. They said, let's go sign up. So we went down to London, we signed up, and by that time, everybody in England was really ready to go home, so we got transferred to that one. We got transferred and we got accepted to that one, so we went from England and went through France, visited my relatives in Paris for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Who were they?
Oh, they're part of my mother's family. Mm-hmm. Their name is Blanc, B-L-A-N-C, White.
Blanc.
Yeah.
B-L-A-N-C.
Fanny Blanc.
Mother's family.
Mother's family, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a weekend in Paris, and then went down to Biarritz, down south, and so like going to Florida, it was warmer.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a room in a hotel overlooking the bay there, and overlooking the whole town. And it was a pretty neat one. Of course, it was pretty run down by that time. And also, of course, in the dining room was terrific. We had these big tables.
Is that the big hotel that the Empress...
No, that's the, that is the, what the heck's that hotel called? The Palais, the Palais.
Yeah.
No, that's a different one. This is the one
Louis
up on top.
The,
Louis Napoleon's wife, right. Empress Eugenie. We stayed at a hotel at the top of the hill overlooking, right by the lighthouse. Hotel Regina et du Golf.
Mm-hmm.
Regina and Golf. And this was pretty nice, you know. We had a dining room and they served us and we figured, aha, they came in with silver platters and with covers on them, and they lifted the platters off and left the floor with sea rations. It was a terrible disappointment. Because we've been eating sea rations for years.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like pretty bad stuff. Anyway, but it was a very nice interlude, and I took courses there and was able to transfer some of those credits to when I got back to the States. So it was quite nice. Stayed there for 3 months, and then they closed that one down. I said, well, how do I stay here now? So I volunteered to go on the overhead detachment there in the theater, and I ran a couple of movies a couple of nights, but then I got a call from the first sergeant, said, where were you? I said, where was I when? He said, you were supposed to be on a train to Belgium, the replacement depot. He said, I don't know anything about that. I've been transferred over. He said, the hell you have? You're not transferred overhead. You're going there. So I had a tearful farewell with the French projections at the movie house and visited his house for a cognac, sugar. And then got put on a train and went to Namur, which sort of gets me back to the Bulge days. And in Namur, there's a big replacement depot in a Belgian Caserne Leopold. Caserne is a fortress. It was really a sort of a big military installation. It's the middle of Namur.
Mm-hmm.
And I sign up in the orderly room and I see a familiar face who's the first sergeant there. It turns out he's a high school buddy of mine, Cy Ginsberg from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you know somebody who's the first sergeant, and you know somebody, therefore, who has access to the personnel records. And the first day my points came up, I was on the list right away to get shipped back to the States. In May of 1946, this was. Yeah. Well, it was the number of months you were overseas, number of battle stars that you had. We had three battle stars. So that got us points, and then months points, and we had enough, and then they would go through these points from highest to lowest, and that was the order in which you went back. The highest point count got sent back earliest, and the lowest ones were a little bit later. Of course, I was nicely positioned then to make sure when my points came up, off I would go. That's knowing the first sergeant. But by this time the war was over. It was starting to be a more even fight with the Army. The Army sort of won the thing while the war was going. After the war was over, I sort of got the upper hand and started learning the ropes a little better and could maneuver things a bit more. So that was very pleasant, even though it did take about 10 months from the end of the war until I got home. And we did go home. by ship, and we went to Fort Dix, and we were mustered out there. Before we were mustered out, we were all told we had to go to this lecture about reenlisting. That has to be the ultimate exercise in futility, obviously. But we sort of laughed all the way through it. And they finally let us go. Got discharged in June of 1946. And 3 weeks after I was home, I was registered for college and was trying to make up for lost time.
Where?
That was at Temple University, where I'd started. I'd had 6 months there before the military, but I was able to cram into 6 months a year's worth of credits.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to transfer credits from the Army universities, which I must say were reputable courses, certainly a good faculty, top-notch faculty. And, but started out again with organic chemistry on a month of June and July and August, in classes that were on the top floor of this building that were hotter than blazes. We had lectures for 2 hours and then a laboratory the rest of the day, and it was pretty intense. But you know, at that time, the universities were filled with returning veterans who were really highly, highly motivated. Unbelievable bunch of students for the first time in years. But that was the environment. And so I guess I had 3 weeks vacation and went right back to school again to try to make up for lost time. And continued through that way till the question of getting the medical school came up, obviously.
Graduated?
No, at that time you didn't need to have an undergraduate degree. You could do 3 years of pre-med, and given the exigencies of the war and all the time that people had lost, they eased up on that requirement. And didn't reinstate it for some years later. So I never did get an undergraduate degree. Not an academic degree. And of course, we're applying for medical school. And then we were all faced, of course, with the whole business of quotas for Jews, which was a fact.
What year was that?
It was 1946.
You got back in 46.
Got back in 46, and went right back to school.
Yes, but what?
Well, I had to finish pre-med, though, you see.
That was my question.
Yeah, I had to finish pre-med.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, 3 years of pre-med, anyway.
Yeah. When?
Well, I was accepted in the medical school for the class of 1947.
Okay.
That's the medical school, and then so there's 4 years after that for the MD degree.
So, three years worth in less than a year.
In less than a year. Well, I accumulated credits from the Army University. I had a year's worth of credits in the 6 months before I went in. And then in the year, essentially, I got another year's worth of credits and then some.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to accumulate in that fashion about 3 years worth of credits.
Mm-hmm.
In one and a half years, really. Sort of double time, just went continuously through all year long.
Mm-hmm.
So in Temple Medical School from 47 and graduated in 51 for the MD.
Hmm.
But in actuality, you're right, I was only in pre-med one and a half years, yeah. But it was full time, so summers off or anything that sort, plus the Army transfer credits.
Mm-hmm.
So we hustled, that's all.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the quota problem. That was a very serious matter
for a lot of
Jews at the time.
Absolutely.
Do you know anything more about that as it applied to you?
Well, we were quite sure when we saw the final makeup of the class that the quota is 10%.
Okay. The quota seemed to be 10%.
It seemed to approximate 10%. That was a pretty close number, actually. And I got to say that that 10% was also after 10% of the class, too.
Mm.
But, you know, it's an unusual combination of motivations. Everybody's come back from the war, and they've had enough of this real world, and they're sort of very academically inclined, very competitive, extremely competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But about 10% were very... Mm-hmm. These people really did things afterwards in terms of career.
Yeah, good. Cool also.
Is there any more that you want to mention?
No, I don't think so. It's all people known in medicine in Philadelphia mostly. Mm-hmm. Very few of them actually leave Philadelphia or the immediate area. Most of them graduate, practice in Philadelphia or in eastern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know quite a few who didn't make it. Went to Geneva and other places.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it got to be pretty desperate because I remember jokes that we were saying that how many medical schools you apply to? Maybe 20 and 30 and 40. Mm-hmm. One guy said, well, I applied to the medical school of the Central Congo. I said, what do you think the chances are getting in? He said, well, they got a quota for white men. So it was that sort of black humor that we confronted this situation with.
Mm-hmm.
How many medical schools you applied to? And they were applying to 30, 40, 50. Mm-hmm. I didn't apply that many, actually.
Mm-hmm. That was your only admission?
Hmm?
Was that your only admission?
No, I tried to get to Jefferson, and we didn't get accepted there, and then tried Temple. You did get there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this was 51,
this
and then what
four, you... Well, 51 graduated.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I met my wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Met wife where?
In Philadelphia. Her father was a doctor there. He was a ENT man.
Her name?
Stam.
Her name?
Was Gabrielle.
Her name?
Her name was Gabrielle Stam.
Mm-hmm.
L-L-E. Gabrielle is two L's and an E afterwards. I-E-L-L-E. I-E-L-L-E. Right. Stam, S-T-A-M-M.
Mm-hmm. And her father?
Her father was a doctor. He was an ENT man. As it turned out, I married the wrong one. There was another Stam, which was his cousin, who was much richer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big obstetrician in Philadelphia. You know, doctors were big doctors in those days.
Mm-hmm.
He only stood about 5'6", but he was a big doctor.
Mm-hmm. You know.
I always expected to see 7'4".
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway. But he was a big doctor or a professor. That was the usual appellations which were attached. Anyway, he was a fine gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
I met her at the Robin Hood Dell, which is where the Philadelphia Orchestra used to play in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
In a very nice setting.
Stokowski?
No, Dmitri Mitropoulos was a conductor those days. No, Stokowski had gone on to bigger and questionably better things.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, Mitropoulos was the, I remember distinctly Mitropoulos was a conductor then. And one time at a concert we saw this kid, this 9-year-old kid in short pants conducting. You know who that was?
Lenny?
No, it was Mazel.
Mazel?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, sure.
This 9-year-old kid in short pants.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember that now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's funny.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the wedding.
Well, the wedding was in my father-in-law's house.
Mm-hmm.
My wife came down the stairs, and there was a picture of that.
Mm-hmm.
And our daughter did the same thing in this house, and these stairs were a picture of that.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a family thing, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it was made about 50, 60 people, several of my fraternity brothers.
The rabbi?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. David Weiss, W-I-C-E, in Philadelphia, Temple Road of Shaw.
Weiss, W-I-C-E.
You're right. Mm-hmm. David Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
And very nice. We went off on our honeymoon. Huh. It was my wife's first time on an airplane. It was in the DC-3, and it was something called Cloud Coach,
mm-hmm.
which we went to from the old Philadelphia airport. The airport at that time was a very small building with a park benches on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
We went up the steps of the DC-3, which was a real airplane. You know, it's front, like these flying buses now. And we flew down to Washington, and then Washington we plane refueled and went to Miami. So we spent a week in Miami, and then we took Pan American over to Havana. This was, of course, before the Castro days, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Long before.
Well, mm-hmm. About 10 years before, exactly. 10 years before, and we had a very good time there. And Havana was a totally different city then, great city then. And then came back, and I finished the last year of medical school. We got married in 50, 1 year before I finished medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued the last year of medical school on the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. The GI Bill had carried me all the way through except for the last 8 or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And graduated in 51 to the MD degree.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took an internship at what used to be the Jewish hospitals. Now everything's Albert Einstein, so it's the Albert Einstein Medical Center, Northern Division.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the old Jewish hospital then.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of her family was in practice, and he was in general practice in Philadelphia, and he asked if I would like to work for him. At least part-time, because after my first year of internship, that was, in other words, 51 to 52. After 1 year of internship, I took another year of residency in internal medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 52 to 53.
Where? At
Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
But all this time, my wife was working in the electrocardiology technician, which she learned in about 2 hours. Not much
mm-hmm.
more to it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working, and we used to eat in one of the fringe benefits, I would call it very fringy, given the hospital food at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The fringe benefit was we could eat in the interns and residents' dining room, which was terrible food, but nevertheless it saved us money.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to get through those 3 years. With not much income, obviously. I was getting paid $50 a month as an intern, and then I got increased to $75 a month. And my uniforms, and all the food we could eat. All the food you could stomach, I guess. Yeah. But we had a great time there. It was very nice. A lot of good friends, very hard work. We'd work very long hours. Gotten off that business because of the problems that occurred with long hours and people making mistakes. In New York, there was a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
So they stopped that. But we used to work, obstetrics, I was on 36 hours and then
mm-hmm.
was off for 24 hours and go back on for 36.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to comment about the necessity of the regimen imposed on interns and residencies?
I never really understood the rationale. It was the old rationale that, well, I did that before, you ought to do that too. Why? I don't know.
It was really, can't you make anything more of it now?
Well, the reality is it was a very cheap source of expensive labor.
Mm-hmm.
Almost cost next to nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, interns are paid something like, or something equivalent to interns, paid $24,000 a year. We were talking about $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real cheap source of labor. And I did things that interns don't do anymore because they have the technicians or low-cost people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Starting IVs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why it was done. Cheap source of labor. It was supposed to be a part of educational experience, and of course that was hypocrisy, pure and simple. And finally, over the years, the bodies that regulate these programs have tried to make it into, and have succeeded in making it into, truly educational experiences. But back then, it was pure and simple, cheap labor. The hospitals needed to run. Of course, I mean, this all contributes, obviously, to health care costs. If you pay $50 a month, the kind of labor you now pay $24,000 a year, there's a fair cost saving. So that's what happened. There was no excuse for the hours, but that, I think, was a bit of machismo.
Yeah. I always thought so.
That's really nonsense. And they've beaten this down. I know. I inspect for the Accrediting Council for Graduate Medical Education. I inspect training programs, and this is something we really cracked down on. They really have to show an educational program for these residencies.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't show it, they don't get accredited.
Mm-hmm. You finished your residencies.
Well, I finished 1 year of the internal medicine residency, which was three.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I was practicing the 1 year part-time when I was a resident, and then I practiced from 53 to 54 with this general practitioner in Northeast Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a blue-collar neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked pretty hard for $5 and $7 fees.
Mm-hmm.
And we did houseboats.